Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, January 3rd, 2006. I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Chris Andre.
Coming up this morning, rescuers are trying to reach 13 men trapped in a mine, but little hope remains. Mexico is opening an investigation into the shooting of a man attempting to enter the United States at the Tijuana border. And Palestinian parties launched their election campaigns today amid growing tensions between Hamas and Mahmoud Abbas over his suggestion to postpone the vote. Portland area weather today, cloudy, possible showers. Later, strong winds along the coast early, highs in the upper 40s. Tonight, rain heavy at times, lows 35 to 40.
Urban sustainability advocates trying to build a model farm abutting Tryon Creek, Creek State Natural Area need to raise $100,000 or more in the next few days to keep their dream alive. Members of the non-profit Tryon Life Community Farm face a January 10th deadline to pay $1.425 million plus closing costs to acquire the 7.5-acre site. They're building an organic farm and education center for issues such as natural building, habitat restoration, and sustainable agriculture. The land joins 642-acre Tryon Creek State Natural Area and residential neighborhoods where large new houses have been springing up rapidly on all available vacant lots. The land could become available for residential development again if Tryon misses the deadline. If the group succeeds with the purchase, though, the land would be held by the Oregon Sustainable Agriculture Land Trust, and restrictive easements would prevent development from non-farm uses. The Land Trust is a statewide charitable organization that seeks to protect rural and urban agricultural land from conversion to other uses. Representatives of the group attempted to negotiate an extension of the deadline with Carl Melantes of Seattle, who's owned the property since the late 1970s. But the extension was denied.
Logging ceased across a wide expanse of coastal old-growth forests through the 1990s to protect the marbled murrelet, a small seabird that lays its single egg atop of mossy branches. But now, scientists scrutinizing century-old feathers have found evidence that a whole other factor besides logging also harmed the secretive bird, overfishing. Fleets that hauled sardines and other fish from the West Coast may have left marlettes to rely on poor quality food. The same pressure also may affect other West Coast seabirds, a point the researchers are now beginning to examine. The findings suggest that fishery management decisions must go beyond the needs of commercial fleets to also consider effects on other species, the researchers said, and they come as the Bush administration moves to drop protection for the murrelet in Northwest, on the grounds that there are plenty more of the birds in Canada and Alaska. In 1992, the federal government designated the marbled murrelet a threatened species in Oregon, Washington, and California, mainly because of declines blamed on logging of its old-growth nesting habitat. Its protection, along with the safeguards for the northern spotted owl, halted cutting on many federal lands in the Northwest. This from the Oregonian.
11 years after the concept was born, Clark County is opening a $38 million community health center. For the first time, various medical services will be brought under one roof to treat veterans and the low-income community. The center promises to ease crowding at the jail and emergency rooms. Clark County Center for Community Health has begun filling up with equipment and staff members of three nonprofit agencies, two county departments, and the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs in preparation for its opening January 12th. The four-story center brings together a full range of health services, from wellness clinics to HIV programs, from inoculations to water quality testing, now offered at facilities scattered throughout the county. UCH services will treat myriad problems, including mental health issues, substance abuse, disabilities, low or no income, unemployment, homelessness, previous health issues, lack of education or skills, and social isolation. This from the Oregonian.
Oregon may not be an international news hub, but the Portland area has attracted a handful of correspondents. This from the Oregonian. South Korea has a contingent. Sung Yoo writes for the Korean Central Daily newspaper. Jun Jae Choi writes for the Korea Times, which shows interest in the case of tigered panty thief Sung Koo Kim, who emigrated from South Korea as a child, but both reporters write primarily for U.S. editions. Jens Eckhardt is a genuine article, however. He's based in Portland as West Coast correspondent for Handelsblatt, Germany's daily business and financial newspaper. A full-time staff writer, he covers a variety of topics, including the U.S. auto industry. Newspapers in the U.S. are struggling to survive, with the majority of Americans now getting their news from television, the Internet, and possibly the fillings in their teeth.
Hundreds of soldiers overseas have started keeping Internet journals about the heat, the homesickness, the bloodshed, and more. The U.S. military commanders in Iraq and Afghanistan now are clamping down on these military weblogs known as mil blogs. Nowadays, mil bloggers get shut down almost as fast as they're set up, says New York Army National Guard Specialist Jason Christopher Hartley. Hartley believes something is lost as the grunt's eye view take on Tikrit or Kabul is silenced or sanitized. Hartley, last January, was among the first active duty combat troops demoted and fined for security violations on his blog, JustAnotherSoldier.com. Throughout last year, the Army, Marines, Air Force, and Navy tightened control on bloggers by requiring them to register through the chain of command and by creating special security squads to monitor mil blogs. The military, at first unaware of the mil-blogging trend, last year began targeting bloggers with warnings punctuated by high-profile disciplinary action. Some critics of the censorship say it could be harder for American soldiers to publicly raise questions about the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the success or failure of the war effort, and the stop-loss policy that forces soldiers to remain after enlistment contracts expire.
While President Bush remains more popular within the military than outside it, support for him and for their war in Iraq has slipped significantly in the last year among members of the military's professional corps, according to the Military Times. Military Times Media Group is made up of the Army Times, Air Force Times, Navy Times, and Marine Times, according to editor and publisher. Approval of the president's Iraq policy fell 9% from 2004, a bare majority, 54%. Now says that they view his performance on Iraq favorably. Support for his overall performance fell 11 points among readers of the Military Times newspapers. Of the poll respondents, all active duty, about half had served in Iraq or Afghanistan, and only 13% called themselves Democrats.
Grassroots pressure is mounting for a recount of a critical vote that ratified changes in the United Auto Workers labor pacts with struggling automakers Ford and General Motors. Several union members employed by Ford said last week they intend to ask the union to release the detailed results of the recent vote. The contract passed by a narrow 51% to 49% margin. The spillover from the controversy at Ford also could raise questions about the changes to contract that are scheduled to alter health care benefits for blue-collar workers and retirees at General Motors in 2006. Disgruntled workers are also planning to circulate a petition inside Ford plants calling on the union to submit the contract changes to a second vote. If protesting Ford workers uncover any evidence of collusion with management or ballot box stuffing, that could bolster objections of GM retirees who've argued the union did not have the right to negotiate away the benefits of retired workers. This from Agence France-Presse.
Rescuers trying to reach 13 trapped miners punched a hole into the mine early today, but a company executive said he was very discouraged by air quality tests. Carbon monoxide levels measured 1,300 parts per million, exceeding the 400 parts per million maximum safe level. The test results were announced after crews drilled the hole. They also sent a camera down the 6.25-inch hole to look for signs of life and plan to move in a camera-equipped robot. The blast occurred at about 6:40 a.m. Monday, trapping the miners 260 feet below the surface of the mine, located about 100 miles northeast of Charleston. Rescuers had penetrated more than 9,000 feet into the Sago coal mine, but were ordered to return to the surface before the drilling crew punched into the mine. Officials thought the workers should be removed in case the drilling caused a buildup of carbon monoxide that could endanger the rescuers. Four co-workers tried to reach the trapped miners immediately after the explosion, but stopped because of contaminated air. The blast knocked out the mine's communication equipment, preventing authorities from contacting the miners.
Defense and space projects account for most increases in America's $5 billion federal research and development budget for next year. This comes as scientists fear that after years of growth, the United States is beginning to skimp on technology that fuels marketplace innovation. The realignment by Congress of research money toward national defense and human space exploration means many universities, institutions, and scientists will have to scramble for new sources of money or cut back current or planned projects. The National Institutes of Health, the nation's premier biomedical research agency, marks its first budget cutback since 1970. The Bush administration counters that federal research and development spending remains near an all-time high and is close to 45% higher than when the president took office. The nation's universities and research institutes fret that the emphasis increasingly falls on development, which tends to help industry instead of the experimentation and exploration associated with basic research. Most immediately, decreased research and development spending will lead to layoffs and other cutbacks at some facilities that rely on federal funding. This from the New York Times.
St. Louis police officers often say they feel as if people are looking over their shoulders. That feeling isn't likely to let up this year. The local chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, a frequent critic of the city police, says it plans to arm residents of the city's north side with video cameras to record officers dealing with the public. The activist group says the department often mistreats and unfairly targets blacks and said it hopes the presence of cameras will act as a deterrent to police abuse and result in smoother dealings between residents and police. The group said the cameras will start rolling in the summer after a series of workshops near Fairgrounds Park where blacks can learn about how to protect their rights during dealings with police. The program is called the Racial Justice Initiative. ACLU leaders notified Police Chief Joe Makwa of its plans in meetings during the fall. Neither the ACLU nor the police knew of any other previous effort nationally to put officers under private surveillance. This from the St. Louis Dispatch.
Tropical storm Zeta unexpectedly strengthened as it moved westward over the central Atlantic on Monday, but it posed no threat to land, forecasters say. Zeta is the 27th and last named storm of the record-breaking 2005 hurricane season. The storm has top sustained winds near 60 miles per hour, up from 50 miles per hour yesterday. While the storm was not expected to threaten land, one computer model showed that it could become a weak hurricane. The storm developed Friday, nearly a month after the 2005 Atlantic hurricane season officially ended. It tied a record for the latest developing storm since record-keeping began in 1851. The 2005 exhausted the list of 21 proper names for hurricanes, forcing forecasters to use the Greek alphabet to name storms for the first time. The 2006 season officially begins June 1st, but any tropical storms that form any time before then would be part of that tally. The first name on the list is Alberto. Forecasters predict that hurricane seasons will be more active than usual for at least another decade.
Unseasonably warm weather brought severe storms to parts of the Ohio Valley and the South on Monday, spawning tornadoes, dropping hail, and contributing to the death of a utility worker in Indiana. Tornadoes were reported in Georgia and Kentucky. Three people were hospitalized with minor injuries in Georgia's Pike County, about 50 miles south of Atlanta. And at least two tornadoes were reported in Kentucky, in Hardin and Lincoln counties. They leveled a food store, damaged several homes, and toppled trees and power lines. No injuries were reported in either county, authorities said. In Indiana, the storm caused scattered power failures. A utility worker died when a piece of equipment overturned on him as his crew worked about 20 miles east of Evansville. Across the region, temperatures were more like April than January. That warmth had much to do with the unsettled weather, according to the National Weather Service.
A pair of extreme storms flooded Northern California's wine country early this week and last. The rain let up over the hard-hit region and moved into central and southern California yesterday, drenching the Rose Parade for the first time since 1955 and threatening mudslides on hills stripped bare by last summer's wildfires. Governor Schwarzenegger declared a state of emergency in seven counties and toured parts of Napa on Monday evening. Initial estimates put the damage throughout Northern California at more than $100 million. The storms were blamed for at least three deaths, all caused by falling trees. The Russian River at Guerneville was receding yesterday after remaining for hours at 41 feet, 9 feet above flood stage. But officials said it probably wouldn't all fall below flood stage until later today. Hundreds of homes were flooded in the scenic community, but most of downtown Sonoma County was spared.
Firefighters in Texas, New Mexico, and Oklahoma battled grass fires across the drought-stricken region. Since yesterday, fires have charred thousands of acres of grassland and farmland and destroyed more than 250 structures in the three states. Four deaths were reported last week in Texas and Oklahoma. One of the weekend blazes destroyed most of this ranch and cattle town of some 100 people near the Oklahoma line, burning about 50 homes and 40,000 acres as wind swept the fire 13 miles from Ringgold to Nakona. The Weather Service said conditions could worsen, with low humidity and above normal temperatures in the 70s, and a region experienced one of its worst droughts in 50 years. Forecasters also predicted high winds, which make firefighting the fires from the air more difficult. Since November 1st, Oklahoma wildfires have covered more than 285,000 acres and destroyed 200 buildings.
The mid-December revelation that President Bush had secretly ordered the National Security Agency to conduct surveillance on international communications involving U.S. residents without obtaining court approval has continued to generate condemnation throughout the holiday season. U.S. District Judge James Robertson, one of 11 members of the Secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, resigned from his position on December 19th, confiding in colleagues that the warrantless monitoring of email and phone calls was legally questionable and may have tainted the FISA court. Many Democrats and some prominent Republicans have called for a congressional investigation of the covert electronic eavesdropping program. Scott Harris of the program Between the Lines spoke with Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, who explains why he views President Bush's illegal surveillance of Americans as a grave threat to American democracy and an impeachable offense.
You cannot have a president of the United States who picks and chooses which laws he's going to obey and which laws he's going to flout. And to see him come forward and give a press conference where he says, you know, there was this law, but it was too inconvenient for us to follow. We need to be fast and quick. So we're going to disobey this law because we have this war cloud hanging over us. Well, these are the excuses that any dictator uses, and it's not as though the United States wasn't under grave threat for 35 years and 40 years when the Soviet Union had thousands of ICBMs that could incinerate the United States. That under that justification, any president who needed to be fast and quick, certainly to detect an incoming ICBM, could have ripped up some of the laws that he didn't want to follow. So this is a real problem. I mean, I always thought that Bush could have been impeached for the Iraq War, for launching the war on a leash of lies, for disobeying the UN charter, and then for this torture stuff that was in violation of U.S. law and Geneva Convention against torture. But this spying issue should get more traction because the American people, a vast majority of them, I believe, respect their privacy. I suppose of all the Ten Amendments, the fourth one may be the most universally revered. People just don't want the government in their bedroom or on their phone or tapping into their computers. And so I don't see how Bush can get away with this. And the excuses that he's used after the fact, which is to say the Constitution gives him this authority under the Commander-in-Chief provision, or that the authorization of force against Al-Qaeda that Congress issued in October of 2001 gives him that authority. They tried those arguments. That's the amazing thing about this, and no one's really picked up on that. They tried those very two arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court on this question of whether the government could take U.S. citizens, in particular Hamdi, Yasser Hamdi, and put him in solitary confinement and not allow him to go get a trial. And the Supreme Court said no. Sandra Day O'Connor, writing for a majority of the court, said a war does not give the president a blank check to violate the citizen's civil liberty. So they've already tried and lost that argument.
President Bush and other officials in his administration continually try to put politicians on the defensive by saying that the president needs this authority to prevent further terrorist attacks. And, of course, with the filibuster against the Patriot Act, the same kind of argument is rolled out, basically saying if there is a terrorist attack in the future, those Democrats or other obstructionists, as the White House calls them, will be held responsible. This certainly creates a bit of fear in a politician's heart, does it not?
It does, and, you know, this card is the card that Bush and Cheney played so aggressively during the campaign in 2004. Vote for us or die was essentially their bumper sticker. If you vote for Kerry, he's not going to protect you from an attack. Now it's, you know, demand that your congressman pass the Patriot Act or you're going to get hit. Allow us to rip up the laws and let the NSA spy on you or you're going to die again. I mean, that really is all they've got left.
That was Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive, speaking with Scott Harris of Between the Lines. The Bush administration has scaled back its ambitions to rebuild Iraq from the devastation wrought by war and dictatorship. It does not intend to seek new funds for reconstruction. This emerged yesterday in a decision that will be seen as a retreat from a promise by President Bush to give Iraq the best infrastructure in the region. Administration officials now say they will not seek reconstruction funds when the budget request is presented to Congress next month. This from the Washington Post. A decision not to renew the reconstruction program would leave Iraq with a burden of tens of billions of dollars in unfinished projects and an oil industry and electrical grid that have yet to return to pre-war production levels.
American forces are dramatically stepping up air attacks on insurgents in Iraq as they prepare to start the withdrawal of ground troops in the spring, according to the Times of London. The number of airstrikes in 2005, running at a monthly average of 25 until August, surged to 120 in November and an expected 150 in December. The tempo looks set to increase this year as the Americans pull back from the urban combat, leaving street fighting increasingly to Iraqi forces supported by U.S. air power. The intensification in the air war comes as Iraqi politicians struggle in the aftermath of last month's elections to put together a coalition government that will satisfy the disaffected Sunni majority, which ran Iraq under Saddam Hussein. The Sunni bloc has been secretly discussing the terms of a possible political deal with insurgent groups, but those groups' leaders have a long list of demands. Chief among these is a timetable for American withdrawal, as well as the release of prisoners. This would be an effective rehabilitation of Saddam's former ruling Ba'ath Party and the disbanding of Shiite and Kurdish militias. Insurgent sources said that they are also including an al-Qaeda in Iraq in their talks, as its involvement was vital if a deal was to work. The shift to air power is part of Bush's recently announced troop drawdown. The bombs are also getting smaller. 500-pound devices are becoming the norm rather than those of 1,000 pounds or 2,000 pounds common in recent conflicts.
Turkey is now claiming that newspaper reports which said that the United States has asked Ankara for permission to use military bases in Turkey for possible attacks on neighboring Iran are not connected with reality. Some Turkish newspapers have reported or repeated similar stories in newspapers published in other countries, which say that a series of high-profile U.S. visitors to Ankara in recent months have been preparing the ground for U.S. strikes from Turkey against Iran's nuclear facilities. The United States accuses Iran of seeking to produce nuclear weapons. The foreign ministry named no newspapers, but Israel's Jerusalem Post, Germany's Tagesspiegel, and Turkey's Sabah newspaper are among those that have published reports speculating that the United States would like to be able to use Turkish soil if it decided to launch an attack on Iran. The heads of both the FBI and the CIA have visited Ankara in recent weeks, and U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is also expected to visit the Turkish capital early in 2006. This according to Reuters.
Mexico took the unusual step of opening an investigation into the killing of a man officials said was shot while sneaking into California. The death is drawing attention to a controversial U.S. anti-immigration measure. The death of the 18-year-old came as Mexico's government continued its vocal campaign against the bill approved by the U.S. House of Representatives last month. Many Mexicans oppose the U.S. measure, which would build more border fences, make illegal entry a felony, and enlist military and local police to help stop undocumented migrants. The death of Guillermo Martinez showed that extending border walls will not curb illegal immigration. Martinez died one day after he was shot by a U.S. Border Patrol agent near a metal wall separating the city from San Diego. Raul Martinez, a spokesman for the Border Patrol, said the agent had been assaulted by an individual who threw a large-sized rock. The U.S. Senate is expected to address an immigration measure in February.
Palestinian parties launched their election campaign with banners and rallies today, amid growing tensions that the Islamic militant group Hamas and Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas over his suggestion to postpone the January 25th parliamentary vote. Abbas said that the vote could be put off if Israel bars Palestinians from voting in the sector of Jerusalem claimed by the Palestinians as a future capital. Hamas, which is expected to make a strong showing in its first general election, insisted today that the vote take place on schedule. It's unlikely Abbas would put off the election without Hamas' consent. The start of the campaign was overshadowed by violence in Gaza and renewed Israeli-Palestinian fighting. The top Hamas candidate, Ismail Haniyeh, told reporters in Gaza that the election must not be postponed under any circumstances. There is growing pressure by Abbas's Fatah party to put off the vote. Meanwhile, Abbas is touring Gulf states trying to raise money to make up a serious budget shortfall. The appeal to the Arab nations followed a decision by Western donors to freeze funding until the Palestinians carry out the promised reforms. Amidst much apprehension, the Erlang shipbreaking yard in Gujarat province is gearing up to play host to the French aircraft carrier Clemenceau. Environmental activists have sounded an alert that the ship is carrying hazardous material such as asbestos. The ship set sail for the Erlang shipbreaking yard amidst much controversy and concern raised by environmental organizations on hazardous waste in the vessel. A Greenpeace spokesperson said the Clemenceau carries hazardous waste and it will not be allowed to be treated in Gujarat or any other part of India as a dumping ground. Much controversy was generated in France after the country chose to send the ship to India. The company that owns the ship says all appropriate precautions will be taken to avoid further contamination at the Erlang shipbreaking site. Greenpeace activists said the ship was to be decontaminated in France and then sent to India, but this was not done properly. The ship now carries much more than the official figure of 50 tons of asbestos. Four groups of activists had filed legal suits against the proposal to send the ship to Erlang. This from the Times of India. This has been the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, January 3rd, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news. KBOO newsroom volunteers and reporters produced and edited the tape. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Brian Smith.
Thanks for listening. We clear the air at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis on Translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on Translator K220HR. Be sure to join us for the KBOO evening news at 5 p.m. And remember to take a look at the KBOO website. If you've got most of your marbles, come on in and play. The newsroom always needs fresh blood. If you want to volunteer, call Kathleen Stevenson, 503-231-8032, extension 202. Portland area weather today, cloudy, possible showers later, strong winds along the coast and in the gorge, highs in the upper 40s tonight, rain heavy at times, lows 35 to 40.
Coming up this morning on KBOO at 7:30, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. At 9 on Between the Covers, Lisa Loving speaks with writer Jacqueline Winspear about her mystery novel, Pardonable Lies, featuring Maze Dobbs, a psychologist and investigator. At 9:30, it's Black Book Talk with Patricia Welsh, Obie Hill, and Emma Jackson Ford. At 10:30 on Stage and Studio, Secure special documentary with six widows recalling the crash of Pan Am Flight 103 over Scotland. And at 11, it's Democracy Now. Thanks for joining us.